from the vet. She still wouldn't give us Fufi. My mom threatened to call the police. It turned into a whole thing. Finally, my mom said, okay, I'll give you 100 rand. Fine, the lady said. My mom gave her some money and she brought Fufi out. The other kid, who thought Fufi was spotty, had to watch his mother sell the dog he thought was his. Now he started crying. Spotty, no! Mom, you can't sell Spotty! I didn't care. I just wanted Fufi back. Once Fufi saw Panther, she came right away. The dogs left with us and we walked. I sobbed the whole way home, still heartbroken. My mom had no time for my whining. Why are you crying?
Because Fufi loves another boy.
So? Why would that hurt you? It didn't cost you anything. Fufi's here. She still loves you. She's still your dog. So get over it. Fufi was my first heartbreak. No one has ever betrayed me more than Fufi. It was a valuable lesson to me. The hard thing was understanding that Fufi wasn't cheating on me with another boy. She was merely living her life to the fullest. Until I knew that she was going out on her own during the day, her other relationship hadn't affected me at all. Fufi had no malicious intent. I believed that Fufi was my dog. But of course, that wasn't true. Fufi was a dog. I was a boy. We got along well. She happened to live in my house. That experience shaped what I felt about relationships for the rest of my life. You do not own the thing that you love. I was lucky to learn that lesson at such a young age. I have so many friends who still as adults wrestle with feelings of betrayal. They'll come to me angry and crying and talking about how they've been cheated on and lied to. And I feel for them. I understand what they're going through. I sit with them and buy them a drink and I say, friend, let me tell you the story of Fufi. When I was 24 years old, one day, out of the blue, my mother said to me, you need to find your father. Why? I asked. At that point, I hadn't seen him in over 10 years and didn't think I'd ever see him again. Because he's a piece of you, she said. And if you don't find him, you won't find yourself. I don't need him for that, I said. I know who I am. It's not about knowing who you are. It's about him knowing who you are and you knowing who he is. Too many men grow up without their fathers, so they spend their lives with a false impression of who their father is and what a father should be. You need to find your father. You need to show him what you've become. You need to finish that story. 8. Robert. My father is a complete mystery. There are so many questions about his life that I still cannot even begin to answer. Where'd he grow up? Somewhere in Switzerland. Where'd he go to university? I don't know if he did. How'd he end up in South Africa? I haven't a clue. I've never met my Swiss grandparents. I don't know their names or anything about them. I do know my dad has an older sister, but I've never met her either. I know that he worked as a chef in Montreal and New York for a while before moving to South Africa in the late 1970s. I know that he worked for an industrial food service company and that he opened a couple of bars and restaurants here and there. That's about it. I never called my dad, Dad. I never addressed him Daddy or Father either. I couldn't. I was instructed not to. If we were out in public or anywhere people might overhear us and I called him Dad, someone might have asked questions or called the police. So for as long as I can remember, I always called him Robert. While I know nothing of my dad's life before me, thanks to my mom and just from the time I've been able to spend with him, I do have a sense of who he is as a person. He's very Swiss, clean and particular and precise. He's the only person I know who checks into a hotel room and leaves it cleaner than when he arrived. He doesn't like anyone waiting on him. No servants, no housekeepers. He cleans up after himself. He likes his space. He lives in his own world and does his own everything. I know that he never married. He used to say that most people marry because they want to control another person, and he never wanted to be controlled. I know that he loves traveling, loves entertaining, having people over. But at the same time, his privacy is everything to him. Wherever he lives, he's never listed in the phone book. I'm sure my parents would have been caught in their time together if he hadn't been as private as he is. My mom was wild and impulsive. My father was reserved and rational. She was fire, he was ice. They were opposites that attracted, and I'm a mix of them both. One thing I do know about my dad is that he hates racism and homogeneity more than anything, and not because of any feelings of self-righteousness or moral superiority. He just never understood how white people could be racist in South Africa. "Africa is full of black people," he would say. "So why would you come all the way to Africa if you hate black people? If you hate black people so much, why did you move into their house?" To him, it was insane. Because racism never made sense to my father. He never subscribed to any of the rules of apartheid. In the early 80s, before I was born, he opened one of the first integrated restaurants in Johannesburg, a steakhouse. He applied for a special license that allowed businesses to serve both black and white patrons. These licenses existed because hotels and restaurants needed them to serve black travelers and diplomats from other countries who, in theory, weren't subject to the same restrictions as black South Africans. Black South Africans with money, in turn, exploited that loophole to frequent those hotels and restaurants. My dad's restaurant was an instant booming success. Black people came there because there were few upscale establishments where they could eat, and they wanted to come and sit in a nice restaurant and see what that was like. White people came because they wanted to see what it was like to sit with black people. The white people would sit and watch the black people eat, and the black people would sit and eat and watch the white people watching them eat. The curiosity of being together overwhelmed the animosity keeping people apart. The place had a great vibe. The restaurant closed only because a few people in the neighborhood took it upon themselves to complain. They filed petitions, and the government started looking for ways to shut my dad down. At first, the inspectors came and tried to get him on cleanliness and health code violations. Clearly, they had never heard of the Swiss. That failed dismally. Then they decided to go after him by imposing additional and arbitrary restrictions. "Since you've got the license, you can keep the restaurant open," they said. "But you'll need to have separate toilets for every racial category. You'll need white toilets, black toilets, colored toilets, and Indian toilets." "But then it will be a whole restaurant of nothing but toilets." "Well, if you don't want to do that, your other option is to make it a normal restaurant and only serve whites." He closed the restaurant. After apartheid fell, my father moved from Hillbrow to Yeovil, a formerly quiet residential neighborhood that had transformed into this vibrant melting pot of black and white and every other hue. Immigrants were pouring in from Nigeria and Ghana and all over the continent, bringing different food and exciting music. Rocky Street was the main strip, and its sidewalks were filled with street vendors and restaurants and bars. It was an explosion of culture. My dad lived two blocks over from Rocky, on Yeo Street, right next to this incredible park where I loved to go because kids of all races and different countries were running around and playing there. My dad's house was simple, nice, but nothing fancy. I feel like my dad had enough money to be comfortable and travel, but he never spent lavishly on things. He's extremely frugal, the kind of guy who drives the same car for 20 years. My father and I lived on a schedule. I visited him every Sunday afternoon. Even though apartheid had ended, my mom had made her decision. She didn't want to get married. So we had our house, and he had his. I'd made a deal with my mom that if I went with her to mixed church and white church in the morning, after that, I'd get to skip black church and go to my dad's, where we'd watch Formula One racing instead of casting out demons. I celebrated my birthday with my dad every year, and we spent Christmas with him as well. I love Christmas with my dad because my dad celebrated European Christmas. European Christmas was the best Christmas ever. My dad went all out. He had Christmas lights and a Christmas tree. He had fake snow and snow globes and stockings hung by the fireplace and lots of wrapped presents from Santa Claus. African Christmas was a lot more practical. We'd go to church, come home, have a nice meal with good meat and lots of custard and jelly, but there was no tree. You'd get a present, but it was usually just clothes, a new outfit. You might get a toy, but it wasn't wrapped, and it was never from Santa Claus. The whole issue of Santa Claus is a rather contentious one when it comes to African Christmas. A matter of pride. When an African dad buys his kid a present, the last thing he's going to do is give some fat white man credit for it. African dad will tell you straight up, "No, no, no. I bought you that." Outside of birthdays and special occasions, all we had were our Sunday afternoons. He would cook for me, he'd ask me what I wanted, and I'd always request the exact same meal. A German dish called Rosti, which is basically a pancake made out of potatoes and some sort of meat with a gravy. I'd have that and a bottle of Sprite, and for dessert, a plastic container of custard with caramel on top. A good chunk of those afternoons would pass in silence. My dad didn't talk much. He was caring and devoted, attentive to detail, always a card on my birthday, always my favorite food and toys when I came for a visit. But at the same time, he was a closed book. We'd talk about the food he was making, talk about the F1 racing we'd watched. Every now and then, he'd drop a tidbit of information about a place he'd visited or his steakhouse, but that was it. Being with my dad was like watching a web series. I'd get a few minutes of information, a few minutes at a time. Then I'd have to wait a week for the next installment. When I was 13, my dad moved to Cape Town, and we lost touch. We'd been losing touch for a while, for a couple of reasons. I was a teenager. I had a whole other world I was dealing with now. Video games and computers meant more to me than spending time with my parents. Also, my mom had married Abel. He was incensed by the idea of my mom being in contact with her previous love, and she decided it was safer for everyone involved not to test his anger. I went from seeing my dad every Sunday to seeing him every other Sunday, maybe once a month, whenever my mom could sneak me over, same as she'd done back in Hillbrow. We'd gone from living under apartheid to living under another kind of tyranny, that of an abusive, alcoholic man. At the same time, Yeovil had started to suffer from white flight, neglect, general decline. Most of my dad's German friends had left for Cape Town. If he wasn't seeing me, he had no reason to stay. So he left. His leaving wasn't anything traumatic, because it never registered that we might lose touch and never see each other again. In my mind, it was just, Dad's moving to Cape Town for a bit, whatever. Then he was gone. I stayed busy living my life, surviving high school, surviving my early 20s, becoming a comedian. My career took off quickly. I got a radio DJ gig and hosted a kids' adventure reality show on television. I was headlining at clubs all over the country. But even as my life was moving forward, the questions about my dad were always there in the back of my mind, bubbling up to the surface now and then. I wonder where he is. Does he think about me? Does he know what I'm doing? Is he proud of me? When a parent is absent, you're left in the lurch of not knowing, and it's so easy to fill that space with negative thoughts. They don't care. They're selfish. My one saving grace was that my mom never spoke ill of him. She would always compliment him. "You're good with your money. You get that from your dad. You have your dad's smile. You're clean and tidy like your father." I never turned to bitterness, because she made sure I knew his absence was because of circumstance and not a lack of love. She always told me the story of her coming home from the hospital and my dad saying, "Where's my kid? I want that kid in my life." She'd say to me, "Don't ever forget, he chose you." And ultimately, when I turned 24, it was my mom who made me track him down. Because my father is so private, finding him was hard work. We didn't have an address. He wasn't in the phone book. I started by reaching out to some of his old connections, German expats in Johannesburg, a woman who used to date one of his friends who knew somebody who knew the last place he stayed. I got nowhere. Finally, my mom suggested the Swiss embassy. "They have to know where he is," she said, "because he has to be in touch with them." I wrote to the Swiss embassy asking them where my father was. But because my father is not on my birth certificate, I had no proof that my father is my father. The embassy wrote back and said they couldn't give me any information because they didn't know who I was. I tried calling them, and I got the runaround there as well. "Look, kid," they said, "we can't help you. We're the Swiss embassy. Do you know nothing about the Swiss? Discretion is kind of our thing. That's what we do. Tough luck. I kept pestering them, and finally they said, okay, we'll take your letter, and if a man such as you're describing exists, we might forward your letter to him. If he doesn't, maybe we won't. Let's see what happens. A few months later, a letter came back in the post. Great to hear from you. How are you? Love, Dad. He gave me his address in Cape Town, in a neighborhood called Camps Bay, and a few months later, I went down to visit. I'll never forget that day. It was probably one of the weirdest days of my life, going to meet a person I knew and yet did not know at all. My memories of him felt just out of reach. I was trying to remember how he spoke, how he laughed, what his manner was. I parked on his street and started looking for his address. Camps Bay is full of older, semi-retired white people. And as I walked down the road, all these old white men were walking toward me and past me. My father was pushing 70 by that point, and I was so afraid I'd forgotten what he looked like. I was looking in the face of every old white man who passed me like, are you my daddy? Basically, it looked like I was cruising old white dudes in a beachfront retirement community. Then, finally I got to the address I'd been given and rang the bell. And the second he opened the door, I recognized him. Hey, it's you, I thought. Of course it's you. You're the guy. I know you. We picked up right where we'd left off, which was him treating me exactly the way he treated me as a 13-year-old boy. Like the creature of habit he was, my father went straight back into it.
Right. So where were we? Here, I've got all your favorites. Potato rösti, a bottle of Sprite, custard with caramel.
Luckily, my tastes hadn't matured much since the age of 13, so I tucked right in. While I was eating, he got up and went and picked up this book, an oversized photo album, and brought it back to the table.
I've been following you, he said,
and he opened it up. It was a scrapbook of everything I had ever done. Every time my name was mentioned in a newspaper, everything from magazine covers to the tiniest club listings, from the beginning of my career all the way through to that week. He was smiling so big as he took me through it, looking at the headlines. Trevor Noah appearing this Saturday at the Blues Room. Trevor Noah hosting new TV show. I felt a flood of emotions rushing through me. It was everything I could do not to start crying. It felt like this 10-year gap in my life closed right up in an instant, like only a day had passed since I'd last seen him. For years, I'd had so many questions. Is he thinking about me? Does he know what I'm doing? Is he proud of me? But he'd been with me the whole time. He'd always been proud of me. Circumstance had pulled us apart, but he was never not my father. I walked out of his house that day an inch taller. Seeing him had reaffirmed his choosing of me. He chose to have me in his life. He chose to answer my letter. I was wanted. Being chosen is the greatest gift you can give to another human being. Once we reconnected, I was overcome by this drive to make up for all the years we'd missed. I decided the best way to do it was to interview him. I realized very quickly that that was a mistake. Interviews will give you facts and information, but facts and information weren't really what I was after. What I wanted was a relationship, and an interview is not a relationship. Relationships are built in the silences. You spend time with people, you observe them and interact with them, and you come to know them. And that is what apartheid stole from us. Time. You can't make up for that with an interview, but I had to figure that out for myself. I went down to spend a few days with my father, and I made it my mission. This weekend, I will get to know my father. As soon as I arrived, I started peppering him with questions. Where are you from? Where did you go to school? Why did you do this? How did you do that? He started getting visibly irritated.
What is this? He said. Why are you interrogating me? What's going on here?
I want to get to know you.
Is this how you normally get to know people, by interrogating them?
Well, not really.
So how do you get to know people?
I don't know. By spending time with them, I guess.
Okay. So spend time with me. See what you find out.
So we spent the weekend together. We had dinner and talked about politics. We watched F1 racing and talked about sports. We sat quietly in his backyard and listened to old Elvis Presley records. The whole time, he said not one word about himself. Then, as I was packing up to leave, he walked over to me and sat down.
So, he said, in the time we've spent together, what would you say you've learned about your dad?
Nothing. All I know is that you're extremely secretive.
You see? You're getting to know me already.
Part 2. When Dutch colonists landed at the southern tip of Africa over 300 years ago, they encountered an indigenous people known as the Khoisan. The Khoisan are the Native Americans of South Africa, a lost tribe of bushmen, nomadic hunter-gatherers distinct from the darker, Bantu-speaking peoples who later migrated south to become the Zulu, Xhosa, and Sotho tribes of modern South Africa. While settling in Cape Town and the surrounding frontier, the white colonists had their way with the Khoisan women, and the first mixed people of South Africa were born. To work the colonists' farms, slaves were soon imported from different corners of the Dutch Empire, from West Africa, Madagascar, and the West Indies. The slaves and the Khoisan intermarried, and the white colonists continued to dip in and take their liberties, and over time, the Khoisan all but disappeared from South Africa. While most were killed off through disease, famine, and war, the rest of their bloodline was bred out of existence, mixed in with the descendants of whites and slaves to form an entirely new race of people, coloureds. Coloured people are a hybrid, a complete mix. Some are light and some are dark. Some have Asian features, some have white features, some have black features. It's not uncommon for a coloured man and a coloured woman to have a child that looks nothing like either parent. The curse that coloured people carry is having no clearly defined heritage to go back to. If they trace their lineage back far enough, at a certain point, it splits into white and native and a tangled web of other. Since their native mothers are gone, their strongest affinity has always been with their white fathers, the Afrikaners. Most coloured people don't speak African languages. They speak Afrikaans. Their religion, their institutions, all of the things that shaped their culture came from Afrikaners. The history of coloured people in South Africa is, in this respect, worse than the history of black people in South Africa. For all that black people have suffered, they know who they are. Coloured people don't. 9. The Mulberry Tree. At the end of our street in Eden Park, right in a bend at the top of the road, stood a giant mulberry tree growing out of someone's front yard. Every year when it bore fruit, the neighborhood kids would go and pick berries from it, eating as many as they could and filling up bags to take home. They would all play under the tree together. I had to play under the tree by myself. I didn't have any friends in Eden Park. I was the anomaly wherever we lived. In Hillbrow, we lived in a white area, and nobody looked like me. In Soweto, we lived in a black area, and nobody looked like me. Eden Park was a coloured area. In Eden Park, everyone looked like me. But we couldn't have been more different. It was the biggest mindfuck I've ever experienced. The animosity I felt from the coloured people I encountered growing up was one of the hardest things I've ever had to deal with. It taught me that it is easier to be an insider as an outsider than to be an outsider as an insider. If a white guy chooses to immerse himself in hip-hop culture and only hang out with black people will say, "Cool, white guy, do what you need to do." If a black guy chooses to button up his blackness to live among white people and play lots of golf, white people will say, "Fine, I like Brian, he's safe." But try being a black person who immerses himself in white culture while still living in the black community. Try being a white person who adopts the trappings of black culture while still living in the white community. You will face more hate and ridicule and ostracism than you can even begin to fathom. People are willing to accept you if they see you as an outsider trying to assimilate into their world. But when they see you as a fellow tribe member attempting to disavow the tribe, that is something they will never forgive. That is what happened to me in Eden Park. When apartheid came, colored people defied easy categorization. So the system used them quite brilliantly to sow confusion, hatred, and mistrust. For the purposes of the state, colored people became the almost whites. They were second-class citizens, denied the rights of white people, but given special privileges that black people didn't have, just to keep them holding out for more. Afrikaners used to call them amperbaas, the almost boss, the almost master. You're almost there. You're so close. You're this close to being white. Pity your grandfather couldn't keep his hands off the chocolate, eh? But it's not your fault you're colored, so keep trying, because if you work hard enough, you can erase this taint from your bloodline. Keep on marrying lighter and whiter, and don't touch the chocolate, and maybe, maybe, someday if you're lucky, you can become white. Which seems ridiculous, but it would happen. Every year under apartheid, some colored people would get promoted to white. It wasn't a myth, it was real. People could submit applications to the government. Your hair might become straight enough, your skin might become light enough, your accent might become polished enough, and you'd be reclassified as white. All you had to do was denounce your people, denounce your history, and leave your darker-skinned friends and family behind. The legal definition of a white person under apartheid was one who in appearance is obviously a white person, who is generally not accepted as a colored person, or is generally accepted as a white person and is not in appearance obviously a white person. It was completely arbitrary, in other words. That's where the government came up with things like the pencil test. If you were applying to be white, the pencil went into your hair. If it fell out, you were white. If it stayed in, you were colored. You were what the government said you were. Sometimes that came down to a lone clerk eyeballing your face and making a snap decision. Depending on how high your cheekbones were or how broad your nose was, he could tick whatever box made sense to him, thereby deciding where you could live, whom you could marry, what jobs and rights and privileges you were allowed. And colored people didn't just get promoted to white. Sometimes colored people became Indian. Sometimes Indian people became colored. Sometimes blacks were promoted to colored, and sometimes coloreds were demoted to black. And of course, whites could be demoted to colored as well. That was key. Those mixed bloodlines were always lurking, waiting to peek out. And fear of losing their status kept white people in line. If two white parents had a child, and the government decided that child was too dark, even if both parents produced documentation proving they were white, the child could be classified as colored, and the family had to make a decision. Do they give up their white status to go and live as colored people in a colored area? Or would they split up, the mother taking the colored child to live in the ghetto, while the father stayed white to make a living to support them? Many colored people lived in this limbo, a true purgatory, always yearning for the white fathers who disowned them, and they could be horribly racist to one another as a result. The most common colored slur was busman, bushman, bushy, because it called out their blackness, their primitiveness. The worst way to insult a colored person was to infer that they were in some way black. One of the most sinister things about apartheid was that it taught colored people that it was black people who were holding them back. Apartheid said that the only reason colored people couldn't have first-class status was because black people might use coloredness to sneak past the gates to enjoy the benefits of whiteness. That's what apartheid did. It convinced every group that it was because of the other race that they didn't get into the club. It's basically the bouncer at the door telling you, "We can't let you in because of your friend Darren and his ugly shoes." So you look at Darren and say, "Screw you, Black Darren, you're holding me back." Then when Darren goes up, the bouncer says, "No, it's actually your friend Sizwe and his weird hair." So Darren says, "Screw you, Sizwe." And now everyone hates everyone. But the truth is that none of you were ever getting into that club. Colored people had it rough. Imagine, you've been brainwashed into believing that your blood is tainted. You've spent all your time assimilating and aspiring to whiteness. Then, just as you think you're closing in on the finish line, some fucking guy named Nelson Mandela comes along and flips the country on its head. Now, the finish line is back where the starting line was, and the benchmark is black. Black is in charge. Black is beautiful. Black is powerful. For centuries, colored people were told, blacks are monkeys. Don't swing from the trees like them. Learn to walk upright like the white man. Then all of a sudden, it's Planet of the Apes, and the monkeys have taken over. So you can imagine how weird it was for me. I was mixed, but not colored. Colored by complexion, but not by culture. Because of that, I was seen as a colored person who didn't want to be colored. In Eden Park, I encountered two types of colored people. Some colored people hated me because of my blackness. My hair was curly, and I was proud of my afro. I spoke African languages and loved speaking them. People would hear me speaking Xhosa or Zulu, and they'd say, "Wat is jy, a Bushman? What are you, a Bushman? Why are you trying to be black? Why do you speak that click-click language? Look at your light skin. You're almost there and you're throwing it away." Other colored people hated me because of my whiteness. Even though I identified as black, I had a white father. I went to an English private school. I'd learned to get along with white people at church. I could speak perfect English, and I barely spoke Afrikaans, the language colored people were supposed to speak. So colored people thought that I thought I was better than them. They would mock my accent like I was putting on airs. "Think say this grand. You think you're high class. Uppity," people would say in America. Even when I thought I was liked, I wasn't. One year, I got a brand new bike during the summer holidays. My cousin Mlungisi and I were taking turns riding around the block. I was riding up our street when this cute colored girl came out to the road and stopped me. She smiled and waved to me sweetly. "Hey," she said, "can I ride your bike?" I was completely shocked. "Oh, wow," I thought. "I made a friend." "Yeah, of course," I said. I got off, and she got on, and rode about 20 or 30 feet. Some random older kid came running up to the street. She stopped and got off, and he climbed on and rode away. I was so happy that a girl had spoken to me that it didn't fully sink in that they'd stolen my bicycle. I ran back home, smiling and skipping along. My cousin asked where the bicycle was. I told him. "Trevor, you've been robbed," he said. "Why didn't you chase them?" "I thought they were being nice. I thought I'd made a friend." Mlungisi was older, my protector. He ran off and found the kids, and 30 minutes later he came back with my bike. Things like that happened a lot. I was bullied all the time. The incident at the mulberry tree was probably the worst of them. Late one afternoon, I was playing by myself, like I always did, running around the neighborhood. This group of 5 or 6 colored boys was up the street picking berries off the mulberry tree and eating them. I went over and started picking some to take home for myself. The boys were a few years older than me, around 12 or 13. They didn't talk to me, and I didn't talk to them. They were speaking to one another in Afrikaans, and I could understand what they were saying. Then, one of them, this kid who was the ringleader of the group, walked over. "Mag ek jou mulberry sien? Can I see your mulberries?" My first thought again was, "Oh, cool. I made a friend." I held up my hand and showed him my mulberries. Then he knocked them out of my hand and smushed them into the ground. The other kids started laughing. I stood there and looked at him a moment. By that point, I developed thick skin. I was used to being bullied. I shrugged it off and went back to picking berries. Clearly not getting the reaction he wanted, this kid started cursing me out. "Fok weg, yo onnesele Bushman. Get the fuck out of here. Go away, you stupid bushy Bushman." I ignored him, and I went on about my business. Then I felt a splat on the back of my head. He'd hit me with a mulberry. It wasn't painful, just startling. I turned to look at him, and splat, he hit me again right in the face. Then, in a split second, before I could even react, all of these kids started pelting me with berries, pelting the shit out of me. Some of the berries weren't ripe and they stung like rocks. I tried to cover my face with my hands, but there was a barrage coming at me from all sides. They were laughing and pelting me and calling me names. Bushy! Bushman! I was terrified. Just the suddenness of it. I didn't know what to do. I started crying and I ran. I ran for my life, all the way back down the road to our house. When I ran inside, I looked like I'd been beaten to a pulp because I was bawling my eyes out and was covered in red-purple berry juice. My mother looked at me, horrified. What happened? In between sobs, I told her the story.
These kids, the mulberry tree, they threw berries at me.
When I finished, she burst out laughing.
It's not funny, I said.
No, no, Trevor, she said. I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing out of relief. I thought you'd been beaten up. I thought this was blood. I'm laughing because it's only berry juice.
My mom thought everything was funny. There was no subject too dark or too painful for her to tackle it with humor.
Look on the bright side, she said, laughing and pointing to the half of me covered in dark berry juice. Now you really are half black and half white.
It's not funny.
Trevor, you're okay, she said. Go and wash up. You're not hurt. You're hurt emotionally, but you're not hurt.
Half an hour later, Abel showed up. At that point, Abel was still my mom's boyfriend. He wasn't trying to be my father, or even a stepfather, really. He was more like a big brother than anything. He'd joke around with me, have fun. I didn't know him that well, but one thing I did know about him was that he had a temper. Very charming when he wanted to be, incredibly funny. But fuck, he could be mean. He'd grown up in the homelands, where you had to fight to survive. Abel was big too, around 6'3", long and lean. He hadn't hit my mom yet. He hadn't hit me yet either. But I knew he was dangerous. I'd seen it. Someone would cut us off in traffic. Abel would yell out the window. The other guy would honk and yell back. In a flash, Abel would be out of our car, over to theirs, grabbing the guy through the driver's side window, screaming in his face, raising a fist. You'd see the other guy panic. Whoa, 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 I'm sorry, I'm sorry. When Abel walked in that night, he sat down on the couch and saw that I'd been crying. What happened? He said. I started to explain. My mother cut me off. Don't tell him, she said. She knew what would happen. She knew better than me. Don't tell me what, Abel said.
It's nothing, she said.
It's not nothing, I said.
She glared at me. Don't tell him. Abel was getting frustrated.
What? Don't tell me what?
He'd been drinking. He never came home from work sober, and the drinking always made his temper worse. It was strange, but in that moment, I realized that if I said the right things, I could get him to step in and do something. We were almost family, and I knew if I made him feel like his family had been insulted, he'd help me get back at the boys. I knew he had a demon inside him, and I hated that. It terrified me how violent and dangerous he was when he snapped. But in that moment, I knew exactly what I had to say to get the monster on my side. I told him the story, the names they called me, the way they attacked me. My mother kept laughing it off, telling me to get over it, that it was kids being kids, no big deal. She was trying to defuse the situation, but I couldn't see that. I was just mad at her.
You think it's a joke, but it's not funny. It's not funny.
Abel wasn't laughing. As I told him what the bullies had done, I could see the anger building up inside him. With Abel's anger, there was no ranting and raving, no clenched fists. He sat there on the couch, listening to me, not saying a word. Then, very calm and deliberate, he stood up. Take me to these boys, he said.
Yes, I thought. This is it. Big brother is going to get my revenge for me.
We got into his car and drove up the road, stopping a few houses down from the tree. It was dark now, except for the lights from the street lamps, but we could see the boys were still there, playing under the tree. I pointed to the ringleader.
That one. He was the main one.
Abel slammed his foot on the gas and shot up onto the grass and straight toward the bottom of the tree. He jumped out. I jumped out. As soon as the kids saw me, they knew exactly what was happening. They scattered and ran like hell. Abel was quick. Good Lord, he was fast. The ringleader had made a dash for it and was trying to climb over a wall. Abel grabbed him, pulled him down, and dragged him back. Then he stripped a branch off the tree, a switch, and started whipping him. He whipped the shit out of him, and I loved it. I have never enjoyed anything as much as I enjoyed that moment. Revenge truly is sweet. It takes you to a dark place, but man, it satisfies a thirst. Then there was the strangest moment where it flipped. I caught a glimpse of the look of terror in the boy's face, and I realized that Abel had gone past getting revenge for me. He wasn't doing this to teach the kid a lesson. He was just beating him. He was a grown man, venting his rage on a 12-year-old boy. In an instant, I went from, yes, I got my revenge, to, no, 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 too much, too much. Oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, dear God, what have I done? Once this kid was beat to shit, Abel dragged him over to the car and held him up in front of me. Say you're sorry. The kid was whimpering, trembling. He looked me in the eye, and I had never seen fear in someone's eyes like I saw in his. He'd been beaten by a stranger, in a way I don't think he'd ever been beaten before. He said he was sorry, but it was like his apology wasn't for what he'd done to me. It was like he was sorry for every bad thing he'd ever done in his life, because he didn't know there could be a punishment like this. Looking in that boy's eyes, I realized how much he and I had in common. He was a kid, I was a kid. He was crying, I was crying. He was a colored boy in South Africa, taught how to hate and how to hate himself. Who had bullied him that he needed to bully me? He'd made me feel fear, and to get my revenge, I'd unleashed my own hell on his world. But I knew I'd done a terrible thing. Once the kid apologized, Abel shoved him away and kicked him. Go! The kid ran off, and we drove back to the house in silence. At home, Abel and my mom got in a huge fight. She was always on him about his temper. You can't go around hitting other people's children. You're not the law. This anger, this is no way to live. A couple of hours later, this kid's dad drove over to our house to confront Abel. Abel went out to the gate, and I watched from inside the house. By that point, Abel was truly drunk. This kid's dad had no idea what he was walking into. He was some mild-mannered, middle-aged guy. I don't remember much about him because I was watching Abel the whole time. I never took my eyes off him. I knew that's where the danger was. Abel didn't have a gun yet. He bought that later. But Abel didn't need a gun to put the fear of God in you. I watched as he got right in this guy's face. I couldn't hear what the other man was saying, but I heard Abel. Don't fuck with me. I will kill you. The guy turned quickly and got back in his car and drove away. He thought he was coming to defend the honor of his family. He left, happy to escape with his life. When I was growing up, my mom spent a lot of time trying to teach me about women. She was always giving me lessons, little talks, pieces of advice. It was never a full-blown, sit-down lecture about relationships. It was more like tidbits along the way. And I never understood why, because I was a kid. The only women in my life were my mom and my grandmother and my aunt and my cousin. I had no love interest whatsoever, yet my mom insisted. She would go off on a whole range of things. Trevor, remember, a man is not determined by how much he earns. You can still be the man of the house and earn less than your woman. Being a man is not what you have, it's who you are. Being more of a man doesn't mean your woman has to be less than you. Trevor, make sure your woman is the woman in your life. Don't be one of these men who makes his wife compete with his mother. A man with a wife cannot be beholden to his mother. The smallest thing could prompt her. I'd walk through the house on the way to my room and say, "Hey, Mom," without glancing up. She'd say, "No, Trevor, you look at me. You acknowledge me. Show me that I exist to you. Because the way you treat me is the way you will treat your woman. Women like to be noticed. Come and acknowledge me and let me know that you see me. Don't just see me when you need something." These little lessons were always about grown-up relationships, funnily enough. She was so preoccupied with teaching me how to be a man that she never taught me how to be a boy, how to talk to a girl or pass a girl a note in class. There was none of that. She only told me about adult things. She would even lecture me about sex. As I was a kid, that would get very awkward. Trevor, don't forget, you're having sex with a woman in her mind before you're having sex with her in her vagina. Trevor, foreplay begins during the day. It doesn't begin in the bedroom. I'd be like, what? What is foreplay? What does that even mean? 10. A young man's long, awkward, occasionally tragic, and frequently humiliating education in affairs of the heart. Part 1. Valentine's Day. It was my first year at H.A. Jack, the primary school I transferred to after leaving Maryvale. Valentine's Day was approaching fast. I was 12 years old, and I'd never done Valentine's Day before. We didn't celebrate it in Catholic school. I understood Valentine's Day as a concept. The naked baby shoots you with an arrow, and you fall in love. I got that part. But this was my first time being introduced to it as an activity. At H.A. Jack, Valentine's Day was used as a fundraiser. Pupils were going around selling flowers and cards, and I had to go ask a friend what was happening. "What is this?" I said. "What are we doing?" "Oh, you know," she said, "it's Valentine's Day. You pick a special person, and you tell them that you love them, and they love you back." Wow, I thought, that seems intense. But I hadn't been shot by Cupid's arrow, and I didn't know of anyone getting shot on my behalf. I had no clue what was going on. All week, the girls in school kept saying, "Who's your Valentine? Who's your Valentine?" I didn't know what I was supposed to do. Finally, one of the girls, a white girl, said, "You should ask Maylene." The other girls agreed. "Yes, Maylene. You should definitely ask Maylene. You have to ask Maylene. You guys are perfect for each other." Maylene was a girl I used to walk home from school with. We lived in the city now, me, my mom, and Abel, who was now my stepfather, and my new baby brother Andrew. We'd sold our house in Eden Park to invest in Abel's new garage. Then that fell apart, and we ended up moving to a neighborhood called Highlands North, a 30-minute walk from H.A. Jack. A group of us would leave school together every afternoon, each kid peeling off and going their separate way when we reached their house. Maylene and I lived the farthest, so we'd always be the last two. We'd walk together until we got where we needed to go, and then we'd part ways. Maylene was cool. She was good at tennis, smart, cute. I liked her. I didn't have a crush on her. I wasn't even thinking about girls that way yet. I just liked hanging out with her. Maylene was also the only colored girl in school. I was the only mixed kid in school. We were the only two people who looked like each other. The white girls were insistent about me asking Maylene to be my Valentine. They were like, "Trevor, you have to ask her. You're the only two. It's your responsibility." It was like our species was going to die out if we didn't mate and carry on, which I've learned in life is something that white people do without even realizing it. "You two look the same, therefore we must arrange for you to have sex." I honestly hadn't thought of asking Maylene, but when the girls brought it up, that thing happened where someone plants the idea in your head and it changes your perception. "Maylene's totally got a thing for you." "Does she?" "Yeah, you guys are great together." "Are we?" "Totally." "Well, okay, if you say so." I liked Maylene as much as I liked anyone, I suppose. Mostly I think I liked the idea of being liked. I decided I'd ask her to be my Valentine, but I had no idea how to do it. I didn't know the first thing about having a girlfriend. I had to be taught the whole love bureaucracy of the school. There was the thing where you don't actually talk straight to the person. You have your group of friends, and she has her group of friends. And your group of friends has to go to her group of friends and say, "Okay, Trevor likes Maylene. He wants her to be his Valentine. We're in favor. We're ready to sign off with your approval." Her friends say, "Okay, sounds good. We have to run it by Maylene." They go to Maylene. They consult. They tell her what they think. "Trevor says he likes you. We're in favor. We think you'd be good together. What do you say? Maylene says, I like Trevor. They say, okay, let's move forward. They come back to us. Maylene says she approves and she's waiting for Trevor's Valentine's Day advance. The girls told me this process was what needed to happen. I said, cool, let's do it. The friends sorted it out, Maylene got on board, and I was all set. The week before Valentine's, Maylene and I were walking home together, and I was trying to get up the courage to ask her. I was so nervous. I'd never done anything like it. I already knew the answer. Her friends had told me she'd say yes. It's like being in Congress. You know you have the votes before you go to the floor, but it's still difficult because anything could happen. I didn't know how to do it. All I knew was I wanted it to be perfect. So I waited until we were standing outside McDonald's. Then I mustered up all of my courage and turned to her. Hey, Valentine's Day's coming up, and I was wondering, would you be my Valentine? Yes, I'll be your Valentine. And then, under the golden arches, we kissed. It was my first time ever kissing a girl. It was just a peck. Our lips touched for only a few seconds, but it set off explosions in my head. Yes! Oh, yes! This! I don't know what this is, but I like it. Something had awakened, and it was right outside McDonald's, so it was extra special. Now, I was truly excited. I had a Valentine. I had a girlfriend. I spent the whole week thinking about Maylene, wanting to make her Valentine's Day as memorable as I could. I saved up my pocket money and bought her flowers and a teddy bear and a card. I wrote a poem with her name in the card, which was really hard because there aren't many good words that rhyme with Maylene. Machine? Ravine? Sardine? Then the big day came. I got my Valentine's card and the flowers and the teddy bear and got them ready and took them to school. I was the happiest boy on earth. The teachers had set aside a period before recess for everyone to exchange Valentines. There was a corridor outside our classrooms where I knew Maylene would be, and I waited for her there. All around me, love was in bloom. Boys and girls exchanging cards and gifts, laughing and giggling and stealing kisses. I waited and waited. Finally, Maylene showed up and walked over to me. I was about to say, Happy Valentine's Day, when she stopped me and said, Oh, hi, Trevor. Listen, I can't be your girlfriend anymore. Lorenzo asked me to be his Valentine, and I can't have two Valentines, so I'm his girlfriend now and not yours. She said it so matter-of-factly that I had no idea how to process it. This was my first time having a girlfriend. So at first I thought, maybe this is just how it goes. Oh, okay, I said. Well, happy Valentine's Day. I held out the card and the flowers and the teddy bear. She took them and said, thanks, and she was gone. I felt like someone had taken a gun and shot holes in every part of me. But at the same time, some part of me said, well, this makes sense. Lorenzo was everything I wasn't. He was popular. He was white. He'd upset the balance of everything by asking out the only colored girl in school. Girls loved him, and he was dumb as rocks. A nice guy, but kind of a bad boy. Girls did his homework for him. He was that guy. He was really good looking, too. It was like when he was creating his character, he traded in all his intelligence points for beauty points. I stood no chance. As devastated as I was, I understood why Maylene made the choice that she did. I would have picked Lorenzo over me, too. All the other kids were running up and down the corridors and out on the playground, laughing and smiling with their red and pink cards and flowers. And I went back to the classroom and sat by myself and waited for the bell to ring. Petrol for the car, like food, was an expense we could not avoid. But my mom could get more mileage out of a tank of petrol than any human who has ever been on a road in the history of automobiles. She knew every trick. Driving around Johannesburg in our rusty old Volkswagen, every time she stopped in traffic, she'd turn off the car. Then the traffic would start, and she'd turn the car on again. That stop-start technology that they use in hybrid cars now, that was my mom. She was a hybrid car before hybrid cars came out. She was the master of coasting. She knew every downhill between work and school, between school and home. She knew exactly where the gradient shifted to put it into neutral. She could time the traffic lights so we could coast through intersections without using the brakes or losing momentum. There were times when we would be in traffic and we had so little money for petrol that I would have to push the car. If we were stuck in gridlock, my mom would turn the car off, and it was my job to get out and push it forward, 6 inches at a time. People would pitch up and offer to help. Are you stuck? Nope, we're fine. You sure? Yep. Can we help you? Nope. Do you need a tow? And what do you say? The truth. Thanks, but we're just so poor, my mom makes her kid push the car. That was some of the most embarrassing shit in my life. Pushing the car to school like the fucking Flintstones. Because the other kids were coming in on that same road to school, I'd take my blazer off so that no one could tell what school I went to, and I would bury my head and push the car, hoping no one would recognize me. 11. Outsider. After finishing primary school at H.A. Jack, I started grade 8 at Sandringham High School. Even after apartheid, most black people still lived in the townships and the areas formerly designated as homelands, where the only available government schools were the broken remnants of the Bantu system. Wealthy white kids, along with the few black people and colored people and Indians who had money or could get scholarships, were holed up in private schools, which were super expensive but virtually guaranteed entry into university. Sandringham was what we call a Model C school, which meant it was a mix of government and private, similar to charter schools in America. The place was huge. 1,000 kids on sprawling grounds with tennis courts, sports fields, and a swimming pool. Being a Model C school and not a government school, Sandringham drew kids from all over, making it a near-perfect microcosm of post-apartheid South Africa as a whole, a perfect example of what South Africa has the potential to be. We had rich white kids, a bunch of middle-class white kids, and some working-class white kids. We had black kids who were newly rich, black kids who were middle-class, and black kids from the township. We had colored kids and Indian kids, and even a handful of Chinese kids, too. The pupils were as integrated as they could be, given that apartheid had just ended. At H.A. Jack, race was broken up into blocks. Sandringham was more like a spectrum. South African schools don't have cafeterias. At Sandringham, we'd buy our lunch at what we call the tuck shop, a little canteen, and then have free rein to go wherever we wanted on the school grounds to eat. The quad, the courtyard, the playground, wherever. Kids would break off and cluster into their cliques and groups. People were still grouped by color in most cases, but you could see how they all blended and shaded into one another. The kids who played soccer were mostly black. The kids who played tennis were mostly white. The kids who played cricket were a mix. The Chinese kids would hang out next to the prefab buildings. The matrics, what South Africans call seniors, would hang out on the quad. The popular pretty girls would hang out over here, and computer geeks would hang out over there. To the extent that the groupings were racial, it was because of the ways race overlapped class and geography out in the real world. Suburban kids hung out with suburban kids. Township kids hung out with township kids. At break, as the only mixed kid out of 1,000, I faced the same predicament I had on the playground at H.A. Jack. Where was I supposed to go? Even with so many different groups to choose from, I wasn't a natural constituent of any particular one. I obviously wasn't Indian or Chinese. The colored kids would shit on me all the time for being too black, so I wasn't welcome there. As always, I was adept enough with the white kids not to get bullied by them. But the white kids were always going shopping, going to the movies, going on trips, things that required money. We didn't have any money, so I was out of the mix there too. The group I felt most affinity for was the poor black kids. I hung out with them and got along with them. But most of them took minibuses to school from way out in the townships, from Soweto, from Tembisa, from Alexandra. They rode to school as friends and went home as friends. They had their own groups. Weekends and school holidays.